Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Jason Flores-Williams. He's a noted civil rights attorney and author who has litigated some of the most important cases of our time. He's been featured on CNN, The New York Times, Washington Post, and has given speeches about resistance to audiences around the world. The law firm of Jason Flores-Williams, along with the aid of Deep Green Resistance, has filed one of the first federal lawsuits asking the court to declare that nature has fundamental rights and standing. The lawsuit is based on the Community Environmental Legal Defense Works Fund's work in seeking natural and community rights in Ecuador, Colombia, and India. So today we talk about a new lawsuit having to do with the Colorado River. So first, thank you for your work in general, and second, thank you for being on the program.
You bet.
So tell me about both the Colorado River and your lawsuit.
I see. Well, the lawsuit is based on the fact that what I characterize very generously as a procedural defect in American law that holds that a human being must be injured by a violation of the natural world and ecosystems to be able to bring a suit into federal or state court. And so what the lawsuit does, it says, let's get rid of this part where we have to prove injury to a human being. Because ultimately, what we know is that injuries to the environment are injuries to human beings. And moreover, there are injuries to the environment, and we can go tautologically on this forever, but human beings and the environment are intertwined, and human beings are dependent on the environment. The life systems that give rise to human life or the life systems on this planet that give rise to all variants of life that are themselves life. So instead of having this human being focused tort system of law that cognizes very few critical rights and cognizes very few critical suits, what we want to do is expand this. And the reason we want to expand this is to rid ourselves of this procedural defect that requires that human beings are the only ones who have standing and that we show injury to human beings to be able to bring suits and sue on behalf of the environment. And as I said, the environment is and human beings are intertwined so that we can start to really address via the law the massive violations, injustices, and harms that are occurring in our world right now that are giving rise to things like what we're seeing in Southeast Texas, what we're seeing all around the planet, the degradation of the environment, the exploitation of the environment, which ultimately comes back around to hurting not only human life, but all of life on this planet.
So let me understand this. So it sounds like what you're saying is that under the way the law currently works, if you had, say, an island that was not inhabited by humans and not habitable by humans, but was full of, I don't know, puffins or some sort of seabird, that in order for an individual to sue for damage to this island, they would have to show that this was, that somehow if you killed all the puffins, that would hurt the humans. Am I misunderstanding?
Yeah, no, you got it. It's a chain of causality that ultimately results in some kind of harm to a human being for whatever entity or person is going to have standing to bring the lawsuit in court. So if you look, a really nice example here is the Colorado River. So let's get back to that. Now, the Colorado River is being exploited and drained and essentially exterminated and killed because of the way our property-based system views water rights and of all the demands that the various states are making on this. I mean, the word critical doesn't even get to it. Just to say this elemental water source to all of life and humanity. It's being drained. It's dying.
And just to be clear, just to let people know,
sure.
The Colorado River no longer reaches the ocean, and for the most part. And what is it, 120% or 110% or 130% or something of the water in the river is allocated to be taken out? I mean, it's just, so before we go on, can you give a couple more, can you talk about like how big the Colorado River is and, or how big it was, and just talk a little bit about that and then move on.
Well, being originally from New Mexico, I'm from the West, is that you have numerous states that depend on the Colorado River for mainly agriculture, but also as water sources for cities that I think anybody who has looked at these issues on any level, would describe as unsustainable. Places like Phoenix, places like Las Vegas. And, you know, ultimately the kind of agriculture that's taking place in the Inland Empire, which drains the agriculture in the Inland Empire in California drains just an absurd amount of this river. And as you said, Derek, the demands on it are over the current capacity of the river, so that we are at 120 to 130% of what the river can provide for us. In most basic terms, it reminds me of Shel Silverstein, like The Giving Tree. It's just, we've just cut it into oblivion and taken everything that could possibly be taken from it. And in taking from it, we are causing not only the death of the river, but we are causing the death of the ecosystems that depend upon the river and all of the species that depend upon the river, which ultimately go back to the health and vitality of the human condition, because we are intertwined with, obviously, with water, with a balanced nature, with an environment that remains somewhat balanced and healthy. Otherwise, we begin to experience a sort of aberrations ultimately that we're beginning to see now in the global atmosphere and environment with things like the degradation of the rainforest. And I know we're getting away from the Colorado River and saying that, but I'm using the rainforest as an example. And the Colorado River falls into this kind of category of natural, substantial, organic ecosystem that, when deteriorated and exploited and destroyed, results in injury on a global scale to humanity. Now, I want to get back to something very quickly, if you look at, say, the degradation of the Colorado River, if you look at the exploitation and the draining of the Colorado River in the same way that you look at the exploitation and the draining of the rainforest, it has always been difficult, and standard environmental law and litigation has not been as successful as we would like it to be with regard to drawing that standing and causality issue out. When we say that, so the river is being damaged and the rainforest is being damaged, which it is, and we'll say, well, this is obviously having an effect on the environment, which will obviously have an effect on, if we're going to remain human-centered, on persons and humanity and their ability to get fresh water. And not to mention all the thousands of living species and entities that are dependent and as an integral part of the ecosystem, which is part of the Colorado River. So, typical standard environmental law to this point has not been able to get around this standing issue to say, well, sure, we understand that when you damage the environment, you damage the river, you damage the rainforest, you are damaging people. But the law to this point has required that this standing causality, this direct showing of harm to persons, be extant, be there, and be provable. And the law hasn't recognized things like global warming. And the law hasn't recognized mass paradigm shifts and toxic changes in the environment. And the law hasn't come to a place of recognizing that shifts in the environment are resulting in what we're seeing in Southeast Texas right now with Harvey and rainfall shattering the records that have been extant in the continental United States to this point. The law, therefore, as it stands now, has been unable to cognize actually what's happening to the planet. And being that human beings live on the planet, what's happening to human beings? So they're, due to this, and people don't like me calling it a procedural defect, but that's the language I have to speak to be able to relate to federal courts. Due to this procedural defect, we are facing and engaged in right now an environmental crisis that could result in ultimately, I won't use the word extermination of humanity, because I think what's ultimately going to happen is that those with resources are going to be able to, you know, insulate themselves from it, while the 99% without resources are going to feel the brunt of it, as we tend to see around the world. So we've got to get this issue addressed so that our law, which is supposed to, at its base, I don't know why it exists, unless it's to address crises and injustice. There's no purpose for it if not doing that. It needs to be, we need to deal with this defect so that when we know harms are taking place via the degradation of a river, via the elimination of a rainforest, via global warming that's naturally resulting from these sorts of things, that we can address those things without having to prove that there's direct harm to humanity or some specific person or entity. And that is why we are asking that we're asking for a declaratory judgment via this lawsuit that the river itself have rights. So we can point to and say, well, here's the river. And the river obviously has suffered a harm here. There is more being demanded of it than it can give. Going back to the giving tree analogy, there are poisons being entered into the river. The river is being used for illicit purposes by corporations like Nestle, who are being subsidized by states. So we, and maybe we cannot come to the point right now where we can show that Nestle bottling, unnecessarily using plastic bottles to drain the Colorado River is having a deleterious effect on humanity and the ecosystems on which humanity depends. But we shouldn't have to show that, have to be able to prove that, because we know it does. When we look at the plastic bottles that are in the oceans, and we look at what will logically and commonsensically happen if the Colorado River is drained to humanity's ability to engage in agriculture and to our ecosystem's ability to be able to survive. So we need to get around this defect, and I know that's not popular to call it a defect, but let's just look at it that way right now for purposes of federal law, and get nature recognized as it's been recognized in Colombia, as it's been recognized in India, and it's been recognized in Ecuador. Get it some rights of standing and personhood so that when an injury or an insult occurs to the river, we can say there's an injury and insult to the river. We don't have to prove that it's having a direct injury or insult to a human being or a person or an entity, and we can litigate it based solely on that insult or injury to the river.
So that's all great. And it this is a smaller example, but when I used to file timber sale appeals against illegal Forest Service timber sales, if the Forest Service would turn us down administratively, then we would have to sue. And this was a problem we ran into quite a bit, is if they're doing a clear cut somewhere in the backcountry where humans don't often go, we would have to show how this would harm us living in Spokane. And so we often had to basically do some legal gymnastics in terms of, oh, we're going to go out and look at it. We might go hiking there someday. And it always struck me as really extraordinary that whether I do or don't go hiking in that place is more important than whether the trees are standing and it's still habitat and, you know, if they cut it, it may slump into the river. And it just struck me as always really weird that my hiking there was more important than the actual existence of the forest. Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
I see exactly where you're going with this. And so let's tie this back to the history of American law. Our law is based in conceptions of property. That's really what it is. And our constitutional rights, the story of our constitutional rights, has been one of taking these basic property conceptions and trying to extend them out to other sentient and living entities. So, you know, there was once a time in our law when human beings were property. And much of our law was based in that. And you would have to perform all sorts of mental gymnastics to show why a slave should not have to be, should not be mistreated. So that's gone on in our law. And now what's been interesting to me is let's look at corporations. So we've had the rise of corporate rights in this country. So the corporations, in many ways, effectively, because they have the research to be able to resources to be able to litigate whatever they want, can have more rights on the ground than most poor people and therefore people on the planet. So what we're trying to do here is, and a lot of people don't like this because if I say corporate rights, some people don't believe that corporate rights should be cognized at all. But corporate rights are going to be here to stay. They're not going anywhere. We live in a capitalist system right now. Hopefully that may change. We'll come to live in a more humane system at some point in the future. But right now, that's where we're at. And there are a lot of entrenched and highly powerful interests who want to make sure that we stay there. So using corporate rights as a model, if a corporation, which can be formed basically, I can do this in 5 minutes with a credit card online, can suddenly have some Fourth Amendment rights, potentially Sixth Amendment rights, to some small degree 14th Amendment rights, then it's not hard to envision that nature, upon which all of our lives depend, should have rights as well that are independent of the fact of whether or not we get to go hiking around nature. This isn't anybody who's spent any time in nature. I just like to say as a very basic point. Anyone who's ever spent any time in nature knows that they're in an incredible living environment to which their minds, and I very rarely use this term, souls, can be integrated and changed, and that we are part of something much larger than ourselves, and the experience of being in nature is a kind of humbling experience that gets us out of this delusional self-importance that we're all engaged in, and kind of puts us in a better place. Let's just put it that way, mentally, for whatever we need to do in this life. So nature being this incredibly powerful force upon which we depend, it seems to me just logically that if corporations, which exist solely for the purpose of profit and very frequently exploitation of nature, can have rights, then we are in this phase of immense disparity where corporations can find all sorts of property-based ways to exploit nature, to exploit communities, to do whatever they need to do, and just to exploit the political system, do whatever they need to do to ultimately just make a buck. Then we need to balance this out a bit by looking at these incredibly dynamic living systems that on their own will thrive, survive, and are beautiful and powerful, and that with or without human beings will flourish, and probably flourish even better without human beings, but we're here too. So we've got to find a way to integrate those systems itself upon which all of this life depends, including human beings and corporations. Though that in itself, they should have rights that are independent of these things. So my hope in doing this is I look at this in a pragmatic sense, really, is that if corporations and profit-based entities which exploit nature, some are more responsible than others, but at the end of the day, they see nature as a tool to make money on whatever basis. If they have all sorts of legal strategies and rights that are afforded them, then it really just makes sense to me that the nature and natural ecosystems in the Colorado River have the same sort of rights, so that at least there is a balancing here of interests, and that the law, and this goes back to that procedural defect that I was talking about, that the law fix it. So that the law isn't just mute and moot when it comes to addressing what we know ultimately could result in extermination of life on the planet, which is global warming and all the various harms that are coming out of the exploitation and dis-ease of nature that is being incurred upon it currently by large-scale corporations, which have far greater rights than this much more dynamic ecosystem entity that they are using to exploit to make money. So this is about a balancing. It's about fixing the law, so the law will have something to say about this ultimately.
So don't get upset at the stupidity of this question.
I'm already upset by it, Derek.
But so, just so we're 100% clear, what you're saying is that corporations have a voice, individual human beings have a voice, and, you know, we could argue about who has a greater voice with that. It wouldn't be very much of an argument.
Sure.
But what you're saying is that the Colorado River itself, or Pike's Peak, or Long's Peak, or Prairie Dogs have zero voice whatsoever as themselves in the current legal system in the United States. Is that what, that's what you're saying, right?
Yeah, that's correct. And so if that's like somebody is weird, like a, somebody's listening to say, well, what is a prairie dog? You know, so first off, let's take this out one place. Okay. Is that, so yeah, so the Colorado River has no legal voice, which means that, as you said earlier, that people can demand 120% of it and that it could be drained and killed, which will ultimately have deleterious effects on all the ecosystem and humanity around it. We know that. The rainforest itself has no voice. Well, it's starting to get a voice, but the rainforest has no voice. And so it can be demanded of because and extracted and exploited by corporations who do have a voice. So there is a balancing in that. Now I want to get to the second part of this, is of where I was trying to get to, is you say, well, you know, prairie dogs, well, they don't have a voice. Well, there's a lot of entities and people in the law that don't have a voice, like children don't have a voice. And so they are appointed something, you know, very often GALs, guardian ad litems. They're very often appointed somebody who, you know, a fiduciary relationship, someone who can represent them in court, an executor, a trustee relationship when it comes down to trusts, things like that. There, the law is replete with well-established examples of one entity or one person standing in the stead of an entity that can't go into court and argue for itself.
So a four-year-old cannot file a lawsuit, but a guardian for a four-year-old could act in the interest of the four-year-old.
Same way as an executor could act in the interest of a trust.
Okay, great. Thank you.
So there, and so that's, so people say, well, you know, okay, you know, I'm stuttering there, but I'm trying to assume what the criticisms of this would be, because I think that's always fair and it's a good exercise. If you look at somebody who might say, well, prairie dog, okay, fine, give them a voice and let them come into court and make prairie dog arguments before the court. Well, that's a dumb argument, because getting back to what I was saying is that there are all sorts, the laws replete with all sorts of examples of one entity or person standing in the stead of an entity or person that does not have a voice. And that goes back to corporations. A corporation doesn't have a voice. And so you would have general counsel and litigation counsel and all that sort of stuff to come in and be the voice of a corporation. In the same way, the Colorado River, and this may be a little bit poetic for some people, but I think anybody who's ever been around it, canoed on it, camped, just sat there next to it, it certainly has a kind of voice. It certainly has a kind of existence. And that kind of existence and voice has been recognized in a lot of indigenous culture that's out there and in the laws of indigenous culture. One of the things I want to talk about is the Te Arawera Doctrine, which is really important to me, which is really what inspired me to get involved in this area of law. It comes out of New Zealand, and Te Arawera was based upon the Maori down there, who were one of the indigenous peoples, or the main indigenous peoples of New Zealand. They have a different relationship to nature and natural ecosystems than, say, white colonial capitalism, for lack of a better term. They don't have the relationship of like, look, there's a bunch of land, let's take everything we possibly can out of it in order to make the best buck we possibly can. I'm not saying everybody has that relationship to it, but that tends to be the relationship of European capitalism to property and land. Well, indigenous folks, they have had at certain points, and this isn't to lionize one group over the other group. I think that's playing those kind of identity politics. It has its own failure to it. Is they have a different relationship. So the Maori with Te Arawera had the New Zealand legislature look at this and say, okay, Te Arawera, which is this incredible ecosystem with rivers, forests in New Zealand, has its own standing and rights to cognize its own injuries. And so this has also begun to happen with Ecuador, with Pachamama, as it's called in Ecuador, with India, the Ganges River, and in Colombia. So what we have there is, this is part of what we're looking at, and I think there's a really interesting opportunity to have a fusion here of approaches to this, is but in places where there remains an indigenous tradition in the law that is still respected, that indigenous approach and relationship has been codified in Ecuador, for example, in, say, constitutional law. I think it's Amendment 77 through 81. Has been codified there, and saying that, you know, Pachamama has rights. In New Zealand, the New Zealand legislature recognized the Te Arawera ecosystem as having rights, and now the courts in India have recognized the Ganges, amongst other entities, as having rights. And in India, it was interesting because the order on that had to do with the relationship between the people and the Ganges River. Now, one of our problems here in the United States, and this kind of goes back to our initial point of answering this question, is that European and American capitalism doesn't truck very much with the indigenous approach to nature and an indigenous relationship to nature. They could be more antithetical to each other. One views it as an integrated relationship, while the other views it as an exploitative relationship where everything is done in order to make a buck and nature exists to make people rich. And especially with this moron that we have as president of the United States right now, that aesthetic, that approach, that strategy is the order of the day. It's nature just simply exists to make people rich and to be owned and to be exploited and taken for all it's worth. So what we have to find here in the United States is we're not going to do very well strategically if we rely upon, you know, an indigenous approach. The courts aren't going to listen to that very much. It's not going to be very persuasive. And so we want some of that indigenous approach to nature and the integral and the integrative way that other people and other traditions have viewed nature. But at the same time, we want to approach this pragmatically, which goes back to, again, when I was talking about procedural defects and addressing it that way, but also addressing this in the way that there's just too much of a disparity in the power relationship between corporations right now and nature. And we need to balance that out a little bit. And also the courts right now are just silent, as they cannot, even if they want to, cognize harms to nature because we have, as lawyers, a very difficult time showing the causality between what we know are obvious harms to nature and the Colorado River and ecosystems, and showing how those obvious harms directly result in harms to human beings. So what we want to do is take a pragmatic approach based upon what else has happened around the world and apply it so the courts really, at the end of the day, will feel empowered to and have the ability to address this huge black hole in our law, which is addressing harms and insults to nature that we know will ultimately result in massive harms to humanity, but that are also unto themselves harms to entities, ecosystem entities and natural communities that themselves, because they are living things, they are interdependent ecosystems, and they are the basis of all life on the planet, and they are the planet, should not be harmed.
So this is all great. And what, when we talk about rights, it becomes necessary to talk about rights for what? So for example, I presume that as an American citizen, I have the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I have rights against unwarranted search and seizure, you know, all those, I'm probably using wrong terms, but those things we understand. I do not have the right, for example, to bop a random person in the nose, I'm presuming. What rights specifically are you asking for from what rights are you asking to be recognized? The Colorado River would then have the right to fill in the blank. Right.
Okay, yeah. Well, that's why it gets down to initially some, I mean, this is all exciting stuff and it would be revolutionary in American law. And this, I want to correct one thing, is that this suit, it will be filed, at middle end of September. So that's where we're going with that. So, and that'll be the first major suit of this kind asking for the rights of nature to be recognized, filed in American jurisprudence. So.
That's great. And thank you so much for doing that.
Sure, sure. So going along here. Okay, let's go. So what rights do you want? Well, this is where it gets a little boring. It gets back to that defect I was talking about.
Oh, wait, I got another question about that too. You've said a couple times this is a procedural defect, which makes perfect sense to me, but you've said people object to the phrase procedural defect. What is the objection? I it doesn't seem objectionable to me.
Okay. Well, that's interesting to you. That's interesting. I'm glad you bring that point up. The answer portends to be rich. Is, we are dealing with the American jurisprudence in the legal system. All right. Now, you're not allowed just to walk into court and say, hey, there's an environmental crisis out there. Do something. This is terrible. Look at what's happening. This is a nightmare. It'll all result in some kind of, you know, environmental existential crisis for all of humanity unless we step in now and change this, which it all will. You do that, you get thrown out of court. Moreover, is if you do that, you're going to be, you're going to be probably penalized and sanctioned by whatever the opposing party is because, which is going to be, you know, a corporate, influence, state entity, the state, corporations, those sorts of things with their relationships betwixt each other because they don't want you to be able just to go in and make vague general arguments about this. Because if you could, then things would change really rapidly in American life and all sorts of violations would be cognized. So what you have to do is take a system that doesn't like change, that isn't really that organic and alive, and find a way to frame the issue in a way that the system can understand. And the way we frame that is by saying, hey, there's a procedural defect here in that nature doesn't have standing to bring a lawsuit when we know that injuries are occurring to nature all the time. And so therefore, even though this is happening right outside the courthouse doors here in Colorado, the courts are silent because we cannot prove up the direct causality regarding danger to human beings, danger and insult and injury to human beings because, even though we know that insult and injury to human beings is occurring as we speak in the form of things like global warming and destabilization of the environment. So here the courts are just rendered innocuous. They're rendered helpless due to this procedural defect, which can be characterized and framed as saying that nature needs standing. That's the right it needs. Now, people will out there in the world will say, hey, you are taking what is an existential environmental crisis. And I don't object to the word holocaust for species. Exterminations and extinctions are happening every day. We are going down. We're going down. I mean, there's really no way around it. We're in trouble. And but you're taking that, and that's like taking the holocaust and calling it a procedural defect. Or that's like taking American slavery and calling it a procedural defect. Well, you know what? One of the reasons that we tend to get our butts kicked so much is because we have this kind of strange purity when it comes to our messaging. There really isn't a kind of purity. It's kind of a dogmatic acceptability of whatever comes down that is acceptable here with us, for those of us who are trying to advance things and really fight on the front lines of American law, culture, and society to be able to change what's happening out there. So we sometimes have to be smart about taking things that we know are crises, taking things that we know are horrific and that are a nightmare and that are a nightmare descending on us as we do this interview, and find the way to characterize and frame those things in a way that whatever system or culture or country can understand. And when I said this would have potentially portend to have a rich answer to this question, is that I also think that we need to think about just talking real basic, clear terms about to people, because I think people are ready to listen to us about what's going on. And there's an environmental crisis that's occurring as we speak. Corporations are exploiting nature. That exploitation of nature is hurting all of us. And so if we fix this procedural defect in the law, the environment that we depend on will have the ability to address, you know, being drained and exploited and ruined, which means that we'll have a way to be able to address being drained, exploited, and ruined.
I completely agree with you. And, I mean, basically anything that keeps water in the river, I'm for it. And it reminds me of something that Neil Everton wrote about, the great environmental philosopher. He wrote about this. He made up a legal case where, let's say you're in 1830s South and there's someone is accused of a crime and there are two sets of laws, one for people with a tiny percent of white blood and someone with no white blood. And you have your person is on the dock and you can either A, try to argue that they have actually 1% of white blood, in which case you might get them off, but you'll reinforce the racist system. Or you can try to argue that that system is wrong and watch your client get hanged.
Yep.
And I myself, I mean, there are many venues under which we can attack. And one of the venues one of the ways we attack is by changing the language, changing the discourse. But at the same time, as you said earlier, we live under the system we live in. And so we need to use the tools that are available to us now as we also try to change some of those tools and destroy the other side's, the enemy's ability to use other tools. So we need to approach on all fronts. So that's why I have no problem with the procedural defect approach. That's great.
No, it's what ultimately you want to do both. That's, you know, that's what's going to take a good argument and make it into a great argument is you want to talk about the justice of the situation. And then also you want to put it in a language that the system can understand. That's it. So if you're into reprogramming the system to some degree, you want to ultimately have a good program. And then secondly, if you're going to plug it in, if the system isn't able to cognize what you're talking about, then it's not going to have any chance of actually entering in and launching the program off the cultural and societal platform that we currently all exist on today. Go ahead.
You're arguing that the river has standing on its own, but to get into court, don't you have to have humans who are saying that they are harmed first before you can get into even walk through the door to make your argument? Am I misunderstanding?
Yes, that's a slight misunderstanding. And so let's look at this. In this complaint, there's a legal mechanism called as next friend, and that goes back to what I was talking about with the guardian ad litem stuff, fiduciary relationships, executor relationships, trustees, things like that, is that the law is, again, replete with examples of entities that cannot, you know, walk into court and make an argument on their own. That's it. Can't walk into court and make an argument.
Yeah, we all know that a four-year-old, again, that same example, nobody has a problem with a guardian ad litem acting on their behalf.
Right. So in this case, is deep green resistance is going to be the as next friend because of the involvement in the Colorado River and the caring for the environment and the long-term commitment to maintaining the integrity of ecosystems and natural communities. They are well positioned to, when there are injuries to the river, they are well positioned to be able to bring those injuries to the attention of the court. To get specifically to your question, that as next friend status doesn't mean that the next friend, which in a child's case would be a guardian ad litem, but in this case is deep green resistance. And I'm not trying to make a correlation between children and a complex ecosystem. It's just the one I have to make with our law.
No, I understand completely.
Yeah, is that as the Asnex friend does not have to be injured directly. They just have to be in a position where they can be a fiduciary and show based upon values and prior actions and concerns that they are in a good position to be able to litigate injuries to the river.
I think that's a brilliant approach. So I asked a question a little while ago about what rights are you, is that in this lawsuit that you're also asking for the river to have specific rights, or is that a different part of this process?
Well, the river, okay, so this fight right now, you get standing, right? So here's the deal, standing is a big deal. To use a very technical legal term, standing is a big deal. So once you get standing, then the entire panoply of possible causes of action are extant and available to you. So let's look at tort causes of action. Assault, battery. Let's say that somebody decides that, some corporation decides, like Nestle likes to, they're going to unnecessarily drain the river using plastic bottles and drain a river that is already being taxed. Well, I would view that as a battery. I would view that as an assault. Right now, the river cannot bring the assault and battery because it doesn't have standing. But if it did, and that's the fight that we want to bring, then we could file a lawsuit to someone who, say, just decided because they were completely irresponsible or selfish just to dump a ton of crap into the river. Toxic crap, real crap, I don't care. And then say, that's a battery on the river. That's wrong. You can't do that. You can't cause an injury. So however injuries are cognized in our current law, and our law has tons of ways that injuries can be cognized, once you have standing, then you have access to all that stuff, all those causes of action. It'll be interesting. I mean, it's kind of fascinating in a creative way to see where all that could go someday. I mean, how would you cognize intentional infliction of emotional distress or something like that? But, but that's way out there at this point. But what's there for certain are things like battery. Things like, tortious interference, potentially, which is an interesting cause of action. I started listing a lot. Conversion. But that once you enter the door, the standing gets you into the door of the courthouse. And then once you're in that door, then you can pick whatever is appropriate to make your action colorable. And once we have that standing and rights on behalf of nature, then we're good.
So obviously the big fear is that this culture kills the planet. So we're leaving that aside and we're speaking specifically about this case that you're bringing. So mm-hmm. what are your biggest concerns or fears about it, and what is the worst case scenario on this suit, and what is the best case scenario?
Well, best case scenario is that we change the world. I mean, it could be that significant. I don't say that just off the cuff. Is that if nature had rights, suddenly corporations would have to take those rights into consideration rather than just manipulating property law and, the first right type of law on the river and buying their way into exploiting and damaging nature in the name of making a profit. Suddenly, there would be rights there. There would be a balancing of power dynamics and interests between large and well-resourced entities and the nature that they exploit for profit. So that's one. That'd be the best, and so it would change the playing field. I feel like that would also, it would certainly change the legal playing field by expanding it and making the courts have a voice in this instance, and I kind of think they do want a voice. I'm sure that there are judges out there, Derek, who are really frustrated, who when they look at this thing And, you know, they have to dismiss a case that they know that, you know, they know that a river is being poisoned. They know that ultimately poisoning that river is going to have a negative effect on people. They know that, you know, 30 years from now, some people are probably going to end up with tumors and leukemia. But they nonetheless have to dismiss the case because they cannot show how that poisoning of the river at that time directly hurt people. So it goes. I'm sure there's some frustration out there. I'm sure the courts have thought about this. And in fact, I want to address this now, is that Judge William O. Douglas in, what was it, Sierra Club versus Morton, in his dissent talked about the rights of nature. So that this isn't something that we're just inventing. This has been there in American history. This talking about the rights of trees, talking about the rights of rivers. And at a certain point, you know, some of our more visionary justices have said, hey, why are we jumping through all these hoops? Why are we leaving in place these procedural defects when what we really know is that if you damage the environment, you damage people. And that when you damage the environment, you damage the environment. So it's there for us. And what it'll take is just a court that has a bit of vision to it, has a bit of strength, is tied into the issues of our time, and has concerns that look outside the, you know, the four walls of whatever office they tend to occupy in whatever courthouse at the time. Now, on the negative side of it is that you are challenging, you know, 1,000 years basically of property law by bringing this up. And more importantly, you are challenging the current wonderful legal situation that corporations exist in America. So in challenging that, you are rattling one heck of a cage, my friend. You're rattling one heck of a cage. Because if this were to open up, like I said, all of a sudden corporations are put in check. So if nature were to have standing to bring direct harms and insults to it, ecosystems, into court, all of a sudden that exploitation for profit, would not be done with such impunity, put it that way. So what the corporations like to do in these cases, and, you know, and very often our states take their clues from corporations, is that in the response to this effort, and they're aware of the rights of nature arguments that are going on out there right now. You know, they've been pretty successful in beating down standard environmental law for some time. But they're aware of what's happening in Colombia, Ecuador, maybe New Zealand, India. They're aware that there's this new law kind of starting to emerge. And so when they see this happening, and they see somebody asking the court to recognize the standing of nature, to recognize the rights of nature, they have to, because this is going to the heart of their advantage and the heart of our system, they have to come hard. And so come hard they will, my friend. They will come hard. They will seek attorney's fees. They will try to seek sanctions. They'll try probably to put some focus on yours truly. They'll try to, they try to make it real personal. They tend to be fairly dirty in the way that they work. And instead of, you know, these are human beings who live in the world and depend on water. And probably what's funny to me is they probably, you know, when you're hiking, this has happened to me before, is that you're out there hiking and you stop somewhere and, you know, you start making your sandwich or whatever. And I like to get outside a lot. You run into a corporate lawyer. And it's very often that some of the healthiest people that you know who enjoy nature the most are the ones who are really embedded in the system and facilitate the way that it exploits nature. And those will be the very same people who probably love kayaking and probably love skiing to the degree that skiing's okay for the planet. And sometimes I'm not sure if it is. But they're out there, and these are the same people who probably have pretty nice lifestyles out here in the West because they can afford them because they're paid well, and they probably like to get out there and really, you know, be a part of nature because they have stressful jobs and all that stuff. They're the ones that are going to come hard because they'll be instructed to come hard, and they'll probably try to sanction me, and they'll probably try to get some money out of the situation and to send a message that they don't want this to be some kind of start of a trend. They don't want other attorneys to look at this and say, you know, that rights of nature stuff is pretty right, and it does address some procedural defects, and it really does go after some real problems in our law, and it may be the way to save the world, man. That could happen. But you know what? They cannot let other people look out there, attorneys, entities, concerned citizens, environmentalists, whatever it is, smart people who just know what's going down. Look out there and say, there's an example. Let's follow that example, because it seems like that, you know, that got a little traction, that Rights in Nature lawsuit in Colorado District Court. That got a little traction. And so now let's take that traction and let's work with it. Let's get out there. Let's maybe do the same thing based upon their model. You know, it's like with the homeless class action. Everybody told me I represent the largest homeless class action in U.S. history here in Denver for something called the Homeless Sweeps. And when I did it, everybody told me nobody would take the case, you know, because it was too crazy, too out there, and et cetera. And I said, you know, and so when I said, you know what, I'm going to litigate this thing. I'm going to litigate this thing aggressively. I'm going to use the tools we have in the law, and I'm going to do it in a way that corporations would litigate it, that people with resources would litigate it. And so instead of just taking up a couple homeless people who had their property deprived, I decided to file a class action on behalf of homeless people. And that class action was actually granted. And that has set up a model in cities all across the country where the poor and dispossessed are being hurt and having their property taken from them. And in the name of usually just gentrification. And again, it's all the same fight everywhere, Derek. It's, you know, it's all about people making a buck. And so trampling on nature and trampling on human beings in the process of doing that. So once we did that model, now that model stands as an example for what can happen in other cities. So what they have to do is get in there. And when I mean they, I talk about the other side, the states and the corporations that kind of work in tandem with one another. And they have to get in there and they have to make an example of guys like me. And they have to, you know, really, hey, you know, he's crazy radical and all that kind of fun stuff that always comes in an attempt to marginalize, because they have to. They have to find a way to marginalize these kinds of efforts, because if these kinds of efforts get traction, then you've got it, then they've got a real problem, because you're going at the very foundations of the system that they benefit from so much.
Well, that is so great, and I want to thank you for being on the program. I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Jason Flores Williams. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.